topic of considerable discussion of the substantive committee, and there's more, and to change that would be more than a sort of a technical adjustment to the bill and a non-fiscal subject, then you probably would need to refer it back to the substantive committee, if you were considering.
Right. Okay. Thank you. We're going to close the hearing on 3564, and we'll get to the additional follow-up information we need, and hopefully a sufficient number of votes from the committee to move the bill.
I'm not ready to move the bill until I see the.
That's what I just said.
Oh, okay.
You're gonna help us. We're gonna meet with him.
That's tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah, we're gonna have it back up tomorrow.
No,
tomorrow's
agenda.
I'm not
moving it now.
Now, don't go anywhere, Bob. I'm gonna open a public hearing on 3302 quickly and get the players up here with respect to that. Hopefully, this one's much simpler.
5 or 10 minutes.
Steve Bennett, if you'll come up. Can you stick around for a couple more minutes?
Okay, I do have redistricting at 3, but I can stay.
Okay, hopefully this won't take too long. This is much simpler.
Okay.
I hope.
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee,
for
the record, I'm Steve Bennett, the Director of the Board on Police Standards and Training, testifying on House Bill 3302. In the interest of time, I think a good foundation for the background on this portion of this issue with regard to 911 standards and training has already been laid by Representative Cease, and I will not recover that ground unless there is a desire on the part of one of the committee members to know something specifically. I would just like to go on record as stating that the full board has met on this issue and is supportive of the need for standards and training for the 911 telecommunicators. And the board, in reviewing the full issue of administering the standards and training for this group, feels that their membership as partners in the public safety team and the fact that they work very closely with law enforcement and other members of the public safety community makes us a natural for it to be included in our charter of responsibility for standards and training, and in interest of doing things in the most cost-effective manner, we believe that assigning this to the Board on Police Standards and Training would also meet that objective. And again, in the interest of time, unless there are some specific questions with regard to any other background or whatever, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Okay, let's talk about funding. As I understand it, the impact is $175,000 to do the initial training. Is that right?
Chairman Minnis, that's correct.
Where does the money come from?
At the present time, the proposal is for those funds to come out of this fund, the 2% that is being asked for in 3564.
Okay, that's not in the bill. It doesn't specifically state that. If that other bill didn't pass, where would we get the $175,000 for streaming debt?
If the other bill does not pass, is that what
that's
your question
right.
was?
If the other means? Bill does not pass, where do we get the $175,000?
The intention within the agreement that we arrived at was that this money would be a transfer from OEM, and I would have to defer that question to Mr. Gandell.
Mr. Chair, David Gandell with Emergency Management. The answer to the question is, without the passage of 3564, we do not have an identified revenue source. 3564 proposes to increase the Emergency Management Division's administrative fee from the present amount of 3% to 4%. The increase, in part, is to fund the 911 Standards and Training Program. The discussions between the Board on Police Standards and Training and our agency is focused on an interagency billing agreement which would pay for the administration of the program, which includes the 911 standards and training coordinator for that program.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
How are these operators different from regular dispatch operators?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, the 911 operators are those individuals who receive the 911 call and direct the appropriate response to the responsible agency. In many instances, they are one and the same. The 911 operator and the dispatcher are the same individual in most of our centers throughout the state.
So why do they need certification and go through inspection procedures? Because you're going to establish certification and inspection procedures on these telecommunicators.
Senator Lee, I can give you part of the answer to your question. I'd like to ask Mr. Eric Gablix, who is the 911 Standards and Training Coordinator for the program, to answer the rest of the question regarding how the program would be administered. The issue received considerable study last legislative session. As Representative Cease indicated, the bill that was first introduced was House Bill 3042, last legislative session. That bill proposed the creation of an 18-member commission to study the issue of certifying and training 911 operators throughout the state. As of the last legislative session, there were no standards for employment or standards for training for those employees. And a concern to the Legislative Assembly last session was that these individuals, the nature of their profession being to expediently serve the life or death crisis situations that are received via 911 should be required to meet at least a certain minimal level of training on a statewide basis. Our charge last session was to develop those standards by July of last year, which was accomplished, and to recommend a training program and the cost of that program to the Legislative Assembly this session. 3302 would fulfill that directive of the 89 legislative session.
Okay, what about the inspection procedure? What is this inspection procedure you're going to establish?
That's what the measure analysis says.
My name is Eric Galvix. I'm the 911 Standards and Training Coordinator with Emergency Management. The inspection procedure is similar to what the Board on Police Standards and Training Agency does now, where there will be a minimum training program established that all telecommunicators across Oregon will have to meet. And that inspection procedure allows the Academy to go into an agency to inspect the training being done to make sure that it meets that standard. What we are proposing to do with the 911 training is to make it user-friendly so that if an agency wants to do that training in-house, for example, the city of Portland, where they would be allowed to train their operators at Portland. At the other end of the spectrum, smaller agencies that would like to send their telecommunicators to the Police Academy in Monmouth to receive that training would be allowed. So the agency would have to determine how they would want to do that. What the inspection will allow is that agencies that do their own training at their facility will meet the same standard established at the Academy, so that we have a uniform statewide training being given.
Oh, okay, because I didn't know what you were inspecting.
Mm-hmm. Would this also help make more consistent training throughout the state so that there are not unreasonable standards placed on new hires within 911 systems?
Chairman Minnis and members of the committee, that is correct. Currently, there is no statewide standard for telecommunicator training. There are several common elements as far as how 911 systems operate, the types of training dispatchers get. There are some locations where the training is not as uniformed or even documented, so there would be a statewide
and in
threat.
Some cases, the training is so arduous that it's unreasonable.
That is correct.
As in the system that we have in Portland. In fact, speaking to the issue that Representative Calori Shipwreck raised earlier, the one dispatcher who made over $90,000, part of the problem is they don't have enough employees. The reason they don't have enough employees is because the dispatchers who currently work in the system really have control over who gets hired and who stays hired in that organization. And if they don't like you, or if you don't meet their arbitrary standards within that agency, you're gone. And that's nonsense, because they have a vested interest in continuing a shortage of employees within an agency that can continue to earn more money by having to be called into the agency on a mandatory overtime situation. And it creates a problem for guys like me who have to deal with crotchety, tired, you know, very parochial kind of dispatchers who could care less whether or not they dispatch the information in a very comprehensive and you know, professional manner.
Another thing on that, Chairman, as members of the committee, with the inspection procedure, there is also the approval of instructors for training. Training instructors that would teach the program either at the academy or at a facility would have to meet the same instructor certification or approval, so that the instructor would, for example, a police instructor currently sends in an application to teach an approved or mandated course, and the academy approves that based on a series of requirements. Telecommunicator trainers would do the same thing, where they would perhaps be audited, where a person would sit in the class to make sure their training is adequate and they are meeting the requirements. For example, the training is being done. And that would be another good aspect of blending this with the Board on Police Standards and Training, that procedure is already in place, and that this would just become another element of that. So instructors in telecommunications would meet that same standard.
There's no specific funding mechanism in this bill, and I would like to move the bill. And I understand that the committee looked at the other bill and said, gee whiz, if. Now, what I'd like to know is if the bill passed and became law, because as I understand it, somebody's going to train 911 people, whether it's the Office of Emergency Management or whether it's BPST. I think the 89 legislature mandated that happened. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Our charge was to establish the program and come back to you with a recommendation on how to best move it forward.
Okay.
What would be required if 3564 didn't pass, we still need to address the percentage or the administrative fee percentage for emergency management, which at 3% would not be adequate to cover our base. The decision package that already went through an exec's budget and this program.
We could have BPST eat it. Couldn't we?
It's only $175,000.
I think we can work something. We can work something out. I think the training is very, very important.
They would need an expenditure limitation, according to Peggy.
Who would need an expenditure limitation?
BPST.
They already have one.
Emergency management.
For what?
Mr. Chairman, this is not in the emergency management division's budget or
right.
The BPST's budget right now. So they both have to, if BPST performs the function, they have the staff person, they have an expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
But the emergency management division also has an expenditure because they have to reimburse. And both of those, even though it's the same money, but it's just like, when you have a billing from one agency to the other, they both have the expenditure. And because emergency management would have to reimburse BBST, they would have to have an expenditure limitation in order to do that.
And unless they do it with their own expenditure limitation. However, we have emergency management division's budget.
We still have
still hovering here, and we can take care of that somewhere else if we need to.
Yes, I wouldn't go in this bill, but they would need to.
Yeah, so what I'd like to do is, I think the training's very important, and the funding aspect of it. One contingency is use the increased administrative costs from the or allowance from the other bill, if that should get out of the process. If not, then we need to search for something else.
Okay.
So,
you mean increase the spending limitation in the executive department for the emergency division? Is that what you're saying?
There are two ways of doing that. You can either do it in their budget, because in the executive department you have the advantage
Correct.
Of still
mm-hmm.
having their budget. And I don't know about the Bureau of Police Standards and Training, if their budget is gone...
Theirs is gone.
Then they...
It's gone.
They would have to come back to the emergency board, and you would either have to amend this bill and write it in, or they would have to come back to the emergency board and ask for the additional expenditure limitation based on the passage of this bill, which would probably be the preferable way of doing that. Once the bill, that way you know that the bill has passed both houses, and they simply come back and say that they need a limitation because this bill passed without it.
Well, we could adjust the executive departments.
Executive department is no problem because their budget is still...
Let's go into a work session on this bill.
Do you want to put the expenditure limitations in this bill?
I would rather not.
Just as is.
As
is. I think this is a good bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd move it unamended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Shiprock moves House Bill 3302 to the full committee.
Does fiscal analyst have any recommendation for me?
Okay. Any objections? No objections. We'll consider it passed and deal with the money aspect of it, either in the exec department's budget or...
Except the Titan belt, I guess.
Who's going to report?
Which transfers the management of the Boardman Space Age Industrial Park from the Department of Veterans Affairs to the Department of General Services. And who's here on this issue? Tell us everything we need to know and no more.
And no more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Gailey and I'm representing the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The department has been, I'm here today to ask your support for the passage of proposed legislation, Senate Bill 85. The department has been actively involved in the management of this site since 1963. Last legislative session, we received a budget note to transfer the management of the Space Age Industrial Park over to the Department of General Services. In September of 1990, ODVA signed an interagency agreement with General Services to actively involve them in the management responsibilities of this function, and Senate Bill 85 was developed to formally transfer this responsibility. It has also been mentioned that when this property is transferred to General Services, the lease payments can be increased. Attached, for your information, is a portion of a 1981 Attorney General's Opinion, number 8005, pages 15 through 17, that clearly address this matter. I just want to make the committee aware of that. The contract payments made by Boeing Agro-Industrial for the past year were $198,540 and $802,867 in taxes for a total of $1,001,372. This amounts to approximately $10.75 per acre per year. The rangeland leased to the Boeing Company has a current market value of approximately $45 an acre. This would be considered a very favorable return on the state's investment since the enactment of this lease in 1963. The capital investment by Boeing Agro-Industrial and its tenants has been $82 million. The annual operating capital that is expended in Oregon is right at $30 million a year at this time. Also attached, you will find a fact sheet for information regarding the Boardman Space Age Industrial Park. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gailey,
yes.
What kind of investment is $85 million investment in the property?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, this has been invested in the farming program that's going on there.
Farming
into space age industrial research. We have a remote antenna site there in which Boeing has invested right at $30 million into that. We have a alfalfa cubing operation that has been developed on the site, which ships cubes to Japan. And We have research projects dealing into the growth of poplar trees for pulpwood. There's several different diversity activities going on out there that this money has been invested in.
Mm-hmm. And this is invested by Boeing?
By Boeing and their subtenants.
Oh, and their subtenants. Mm-hmm. So the will the transfer interfere with leasing of the property to the different tenants when the property is the control of it is transferred to the general services? Is that going to interfere with a lease to the different tenants?
That will not interfere with the lease to the different tenants. That's why it's being transferred to general services.
So what's the advantage of this being managed by general services?
Mr. Chair, if I might, David Small, Senior Budget Analyst, Executive Department. Again, this is in response to a budget note from the last legislative session. It's possible that the last session thought it was more appropriate for general services, the normal property management agency for state government, to handle Boardman.
But if there's no change in the use of the properties, I just want to say, so there's no advantage except general services is supposed to be doing the management of our of the state-owned lands.
That is correct. And perhaps general services has more expertise than Veterans Affairs in this area.
Maybe we'll make more rental income by changing the management, changing the departments.
Mr. Chair, we're speculating as to what the last session thought. I can't speak for them. I'm just trying to interpret what I might have thought if I were in their shoes. I can't go any further than that.
So it's like a 99-year lease to the
77-year
lease that expires the year 2040.
Yeah, so we're pretty much bound until that time.
I was just going to read for the committees, if this hasn't been done before I came in here, the budget note, which is in the department of Veterans Department budget, as a matter of fact, rather than the General Services budget, said that the department was instructed to contract to the extent allowed by law and existing lease agreements with General Services for management of the Boardman Space Age Industrial Park. And further, the department is instructed to work with the Executive Department and the Department of General Services to make arrangements, including the drafting of needed legislation for the permanent transfer of responsibility for the park. According to the Executive Department's statewide asset management plan that's under development. So this had two sides. One of it was that the subcommittee that listens to the budget of the Veterans Department didn't particularly feel that the Veterans Department ought to continue after years of not owning this, of no longer owning this property, to management, since they were not otherwise in that business. And the Executive Department's budget, remember, there was a budget note that directed the Executive Department to take steps to develop a centralized surplus, land management function that presumably would put one state agency, and that was the Department of General Services, in charge of managing all of the lands so that they would be put to maximum use. Now, admittedly, Boardman Industrial Park's use is pretty well tied down by the Boeing lease at the moment. But that was in general. It was to simply, generally, to get it into, have it conform with the Executive Department budget note, and then to just not have the Veterans Department have this function, which isn't related to their mission.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Shipp.
Are we in a work session? I'd like to move Senate Bill 85 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Shipwreck moves Senate Bill 85 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
I have one more question for them, which is how big is the park?
The park consists of approximately 95,000 acres.
Okay. No objections, and we'll consider it going to the full committee. And we'll move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 781.
Ross,
We just did 85.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Roz Sherrick is going to be the analyst on this. She's the
industrial veterans department.
Person who did the fiscal analysis, I mean, the fiscal impact statement.
Okay.
Do we have a new fiscal analyst? Do we have a new fiscal analyst?
No, Roz works on fiscal impact statements, and she's doing this bill in place of John Latimer.
Okay. Let's do discussion here. Do you want to do some opening comments?
No, I believe maybe Treasury's prepared with some comments.
Everything we want to know, and not one word more.
I understand. Mr. Chairman.
How about give us some samples?
Yes. Members, before the samples, I'm Michael Ryan, Executive Assistant to the State
Treasurer. It's not a hat. This committee's only interested in hats.
That's right.
Hats?
Next, I have some really beautiful stuff to share. The bill before you is a simple bill. It's an important bill as well. The essence of the bill would allow the state to issue commemorative coins for the first time, and the proceeds of those coins would go to state parks, and the purpose would be for parkland acquisition and development and for historical observances, that is, related to historical areas and sites, and the proceeds would be directed by a commission inside of parks, not by the state treasury. We anticipate other states have moved into the printing and distribution marketing, if you will, of commemorative coins, and they have produced revenue for the states that have been used in varying ways. We suggest they go into state parks. We've taken a very conservative estimate in talking with the individuals that are in the minting business to get an estimate of the type of proceeds you might be looking for. We're estimating something in the neighborhood of $250,000 in gross profit, with approximately $187,000 or thereabouts being available for these type of purposes during the next biennial period for state parks. These are
what
truly...
What happens, Mr. Chairman?
Senator,
what happens to the difference between $250,000 and $187,000?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, basically the cost of entering into the contract with the vendor, the marketing, and the actual printing, and the purchase of the quality of the materials used in the coins themselves.
Is this going to be gold?
The example that we used was a gold example. It would be possible to print actually in silver or in other type of coins, but in the example that was used was a gold example. Can I just take a second just to show you the type of coin that we're talking about here?
Set. Whose picture gets to be on these?
These are the types.
They're really beautiful.
What did you say? Whose picture is it?
I actually didn't respond to that.
This is an elegant.
However, since the question was asked, I do have a couple of minor amendments that I'd like to suggest to the membership for inclusion in the bill. The intent here would be to have an imprint of the State of Oregon seal on one side. We would like to seek the professional advice of the mint companies themselves on what would provide a truly marketable type of a coin. On the other side, it could be the imprint of a park. It could be the imprint of an animal. We would seek the professional advice from the folks that literally in the field and understand the marketplace. I have those two amendments here for you.
Okay. Senator, you get a question.
Mr. Chairman, what are you selling these coins for?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Yee, the example that we suggested was $500 per coin. And then we did our calculation based on the issue of that and came up with our projected profit.
$500 for one?
Yes, a gold coin.
This is gold and silver.
That is silver, Senator Yee.
Okay. Oh, that's silver?
Yes.
How much are the silver ones?
I don't know exactly what that would be. That would be, it would be substantially less than the $500, of course, because it wouldn't have the gold content.
Do you have a gold one to show us?
No, I'm sorry, I did not, Senator.
We're not trustworthy enough to run a gold
one. But I am. Just make sure you're watching where they're going. Yeah.
Make sure you count how many there are.
The two amendments that I'm suggesting, Mr. Chairman and members, would both flow into the bill. On the first page, line 7 in section 2, we would insert the words after the word tender there on line 7, and may include the use of the state seal of Oregon with the appropriate ORS site. And that would then be followed by the sentence, if the state treasurer decides to issue commemorative coins using the state seal, no private entity shall be authorized to use the state seal on any commemorative coins. This really is coming at the suggestion of some of these mint experts that we were talking to and would disallow the use of the state seal on other commemorative coins other than those issued by the state, preserving, if you will, the value of those issued by the state and the marketability.
Okay.
That's the extent of my opening comments.
All right.
Be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, so the anticipated revenue is not very much.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee.
The word paid, comma, on the next line, at the next page, that would be deleted, and then the next the sentence would start. 2.5% of the amount in emergency communications.
Okay. Senator Yee makes
the amendment.
The motion to move that amendment as stated by LFO. Any objections? Hearing none, we'll consider that adopted. Okay. So that gets us to where we want to be. Any additional comments?
Unless the committee has any questions.
Okay. Any additional questions? Comments?
Mr. Chairman, these two handwritten charts are the same as these two charts. The amount are slightly different, but I figure you ran them on.
Okay. Discussion. Now, can we get a motion on the main bill as amended? Senator Fogbush moves House Bill 3564 as amended to the full committee for the due pass recommendation discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I want to say I'm a lot more comfortable with the bill today than yesterday. The explanation was good, and the 20 phone calls I got makes a lot of difference. So I'm comfortable in supporting.
Were they all from constituents?
Most of them. My fire chiefs and city managers and...
Okay, any objections to the bill? Representative Shipwreck is a no vote.
I vote aye.
No other objections, and we consider the bill adopted.
Thank you.
And we're adjourned.
Did you say we're adjourned?
Yes. In tax.
Yeah, this is oil.
Was first to come up with some numbers that make the bill revenue neutral, purely to address the revenues that are currently being collected this biennium and distribute them according to a percentage formula. And in the process of doing that, we also identified that the unitary assessment scheme established in the original bill, if imposed, would have resulted in a net revenue reduction. So I am proposing an adjustment to the unitary rate to make that revenue neutral also. Then the second part of what the tables have, gather increased revenue for the victim's compensation account and for the state police. And that in a nutshell is what we have here.
Okay. Does everybody have copies of the tables
that we
shared with them yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as I understand it then, the existing amounts that would have been garnished, which are in law but not effective, is that correct, would have not created enough revenue
right.
to make it?
The unitary assessment scheme, if you look on table 2, the unitary assessment scheme in Senate Bill 103 as currently written would have resulted in a net reduction to current collections of $2.5 million.
So if we look at the column that says Senate Bill 103 Unitary Assessment, that shows us what we currently would have if we pass the bill as it currently exists. And 1991 assessments collected shows us the range of what's currently being collected.
Correct.
And then we have estimates, and then we have LFO recommended assessment levels. To come up with a revenue neutral
bill.
Which would be 65 for felonies, 45 for misdemeanors. There's no DUI category, DUII category, which is important. And a violation, 25, and an infraction would be $12. That would make it revenue neutral. Okay? And option table 3.
Table 3 is the enhanced revenue.
All right, and if we look at LFO recommended, that would...
That is the sum that would generate $3.7 million to fund a million for the victim's compensation account and $2.5 million for the state police.
Okay. And we would also then, in Table 4, need to change the percent distribution.
Right.
And this would... hold everyone else harmless, is that correct?
Correct. And the one thing about Table 4, the fourth thing that I neglected to mention that I did here was to reflect the adjustment to the reserve amount that was requested by BPST and Victims Compensation. So if you look at the reserve total, it has gone from $847,000 to $1.1 million.
Okay. Could you explain that reserve to us a little bit so that we understand?
Mr. Chairman, what page is this?
This would be option 4.
Table 4. As I understand it, the reserve account ensures that if in any given month collections do not equal the monthly amount that the agency expects, that the difference would be made up out of the reserve. And then the reserve would be replenished the following month.
Okay. Then these are also biennial figures.
Correct.
So if we look at the figure for OSP, the bill is only implemented in the second half of the 1991-93 biennium, therefore it would only raise 1.25.
Right.
Million. And that's where we get to the 1.2 million for the intoxilizer machines that we deferred in the base budget. Okay. Any discussion?
No, we were only going to buy 30 intoxicants.
We bought those with general fund monies. We had 1.5 million. 300,000 went to buy the initial machines up front.
Right.
We deferred 1.2 million to be purchased with unitary tax or unitary assessment monies if we could make that work.
So does that mean the first year we'll buy 30 and the second year we buy 90?
Should buy the rest. Right, that's right. Should buy the rest of it.
Oh, that's where the rest of the money comes from.
That's right.
And this is not going to be implemented until second year of the biennium.
That's right. Okay.
Do you want a motion?
Well, yeah, in the motion...
Are we in work session?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is move to the LFO recommended on table 3 so that we're raising the money. If we go to any other table, we're stuck.
That was going to be my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
See, we really think, you know, this is a fee bill, well, isn't it, Mr. Chairman?
This is a fee bill, and this is a fee bill that comes from bad guys and girls.
Do you think you can convince your caucus to support this fee bill?
Which part of it? I don't know. I have no idea.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
Is this going to increase indigent defense fees?
No.
Because of all these increase in fees and they can't pay it?
In fact, Robin, why don't you address that? Because Robin looked at fairly extensively what's collected currently. And what cannot be collected.
Actually, if you look at Table 3 and the first column in Table 3 where it says 1991 assessments collected, mm-hmm. what the Judicial Department and I did was go back and look at what is currently being collected on for... BPST, CICA, and motor vehicle records. And it ends up that, for example, on a felony case, for those where the assessments are actually collected, it is an amount of $85. So the LFO recommendation, if you look over under that column, you'll see that what we are recommending is the same as what is currently being collected.
In other words, they're basing it on the number of people who currently are paying,
mm-hmm.
not those they can't collect from, but those that we know currently are paying.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out on this discussion, Mr. Chairman, I particularly appreciate raising the additional money for the, I don't know the term, but those people that have been hurt due to a crime that victims compensation account,
and
I appreciate that it's in the deficit right now. I think it's very important that we boost that back up for people that unfortunately got hurt.
I agree. And Representative Shipwreck then moves the LFO recommended assessment amounts and the distribution percentage formula on table 4 be adopted by the subcommittee right. incorporated in Senate Bill 103. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
I have another question.
Senator Yee.
And Robin, is this a drop on under the category of violation, $27 to $34, and our assessment is $16?
Basically, yes.
Well, so why are we dropping it?
Robin? Would you like to raise it?
Yeah. What I tried to do was stay within a certain, I didn't want to exceed a certain amount that we were raising through the recommended assessment amounts. So I left the violation and infraction amounts low. It corresponds more to what was recommended in the earlier unitary assessment amount. It was just a recommendation that we made based on the total dollar amount that we were looking to raise.
So actually it's more realistic to stay in that range than to raise it too high and not be able to collect it.
Correct, that's part of it too.
That's right. Okay, any objections to the motion made by Representative Shipwreck? Hearing none, we'll consider them adopted then. Main motion.
Pardon?
We're ready for it. We should be ready for main motion. Anything else we need to do?
Send it to the committee?
I know. Do we need to do
Mr. Chairman, there are probably two other items that were brought to your attention the other day.
And I forgot it.
One is the minimum payouts under the guarantee from the reserve account, and another, the state treasurer is here with concern about
right.
their designation as being the receiver and distributor.
Okay, I'm not sure
does
about
everything.
Did you? This is the issue we discussed yesterday. There was a. Is that the phased implementation for the victims assistance? Easier.
Yeah.
Oh, I missed it. Okay, tell me about it. What do we need to do? Pick an issue. Tell me all about it.
There was written testimony submitted during the work session last week.
Yeah.
The Director of Cash Management for Oregon State Treasury is requesting that Senate Bill 103 be amended to replace the State Treasurer with the Department of Revenue as it relates to program issues.
Okay.
Any reason we shouldn't do it?
Okay. Anybody want to make a motion, change of designation, or at least discussion on it?
I got to ask a question.
Go ahead.
I don't remember this discussion.
I don't remember the discussion either for some reason.
When you say program issues, what does that mean?
I actually don't know.
Okay, somebody from the State Treasurer's office. Go up here and tell us all about
this. I figured he might have an answer.
People have copies in there.
Well, I don't recall that. That's what I'm looking for.
I don't either.
Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about this?
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Brubaker. I'm Director of Cash Management for the Oregon State Treasury. The reason for the requested amendment as it relates to program issues deals with the fact that the State Treasurer's Office operates as the central bank for all state agencies as well as local governments and the local government investment pool. And we try to stay away from what we refer to as program issues or where we initiate financial transactions. It tends to increase the internal controls within the state of Oregon when we function as the bank where the state agency would initiate the transaction of funds either in or out of the Treasury, and the Treasury actually records those transactions. We currently track in excess of 200,000 deposits and in excess of 8 million checks and warrants annually. So it's an issue of trying to continue to operate as a assembly plant, so to speak, and not get into the program issues, as well as to continue to keep the strong internal controls that Oregon has by the separation of duties.
So you're arguing for the deletion of the State Treasurer as the place where the deposit of these funds would go?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It's on 103A, it's on page 3, lines 19 and 44, and on page 4, lines 16 and 38. And this would be consistent with the way other legislation has been handled in the legislature in Oregon.
Okay, so we just eliminate where it says State Treasurer and put the Department of Revenue in.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody from the Department of Revenue here? Do they care? We don't know.
Mr. Chairman, this would be consistent with the way legislation has been dealt with in the past.
Okay, what legislation? Where do we consistently do it this
way?
Anywhere where a state agency has been given responsibility to initiate deposits or withdrawals from various cash accounts.
Okay. So the agency itself is actually handling the paying out and receipt of the monies.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
and the reason for that is because the state treasury is not the actual depository. Okay. We utilize the branch network of 15 banks in Oregon.
Okay. I think this is coming back to me with the Department of Revenue at least. Anybody want to make a motion?
Well, on that? Just one more last clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
It's my understanding in other sections of the bill, the Department of Revenue, I can see, is referenced, is responsible for assuring that monies in this account I'm looking at. Is the objection that in this one area having to do with looks like marijuana, they're referencing the State Treasurer's office? Okay, I think I understand his problem. Just on this one certain, apparently, this one certain violation, they've referenced you instead of the Department of Revenue.
Yes.
So you just said that.
Because we didn't understand.
Okay. I'll make that motion.
Okay. Representative Shiprack moves the amendment submitted by the State Treasurer's Office.
Which page
CPA,
do you see marijuana?
That's the section, Senator Yee, section 4 has to do with the controlled substances, and they talk a lot about cannabis, dried leaves, stems, and flowers.
Okay, no objections to the amendments by the State Treasurer's Office, we'll consider those adopted.
What is one aver dubus ounce of dry leaves?
That's the weed, Acapulco gold. No stems, no seeds that you don't need.
Chairman Minnis, we also need an amendment to the bill to include the state police in the victims in the...
That was part of our original amendment that we made.
Okay.
It's included in the distribution formula.
Okay.
So we'll let's just make sure we have legislative counsel draft those so they're consistent with the rest of the world.
And also, the other change is to segregate DUII from out of, it is currently in Senate Bill 103 as written, it is included in misdemeanors. And the...
Okay. So we need you want to have a specific motion that we sever DUIIs from the misdemeanor category.
If that's necessary.
I don't think it's necessary because the motion we had created that. It had contemplated the different categories with DUII as a separate category, so...
So is DUII a felony?
No.
Is that conviction a felony?
No.
Why do we have to separate?
Only because if you look at the amount of money they're currently being charged in the way it was incorporated in the misdemeanor category, the DUIIs were getting a tremendous break. And so in our discussions, we looked at it and said that that ought not be, because politically it's not a great idea to give DUIIs a break anywhere. And
which
practically,
which
too.
Table
if you look on this table, table two or three, but misdemeanors are being charged 32 to 55. Mm-hmm. DUII is being charged 54 to 75.
Mm-hmm.
The unitary assessment amount for DUII would have been 35, because under unitary assessment, DUII is included in misdemeanors. So what we would do is separate this out as a separate category and impose a separate unitary assessment.
Even though they're the same amount?
They won't be the same. If you look on table three, what we are recommending is that...
I see.
Okay.
You okay?
That's the reason for separating them.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
These are the recommended amounts here.
Right.
It's number five on
your issue. Okay. Sorry. Number five on our issue list.
That is also on the distribution table.
It is? There are no papers than Attorney General.
Yeah, hey, I pared it down.
You did do that. You buried everything. Give me that thing. This one here?
Mm-hmm. Those were the two requests, the BTST and Justice Department
okay.
came in.
Does everybody have a copy of the summary of issues sheet that Elifo handed us? You've got yours.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at number five...
Wait. Okay, I have.
Okay, number five, there's a request by BPST to upgrade their reserve account balance to $395,576, and the Department of Justice recommends that their base reserve be increased to $175,000 for the Victims Assistance Program.
Is that what CICA is?
Right.
Victims Assistance Program.
What is CICA?
Crime Injury Compensation Account.
Okay, Crime Injury Compensation Account.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there any objections to doing that?
Okay.
There's no objections, so we'll consider that adopted. Now I think we're ready for the main motion. Okay.
Our percentage distribution is going to come up with that base reserve.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Anybody out here having a conniption fit or anything? Or
did we take care of Marine Board who expressed concern last night?
That was all taken care of. Nobody's having a conniption fit. Everybody's happy, right? Okay, Senator Yee moves Senate Bill 103 to the full committee as amended with the due pass recommendation. Any objections? Hearing none, we're adjourned. Thank you very much. Archer, do you want to explain what this bill does?
Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I don't know if there's anybody here to testify on this bill from the executive department or not. It was submitted by the executive department. This bill deals with the reemployment assistance reserve account in the Department of Insurance and Finance. This account is available for agencies. It reimburses certain costs to agencies for employing injured workers, and the idea being that you get injured workers back into the workforce as soon as possible, avoid paying workers' compensation costs for time loss. One of the impediments to doing that has been, in the past, has been a reluctance on the part of state agencies to do this because the costs go again of that reemployment reserve, even though they are reimbursed by the Insurance and Finance Department through this fund, go against a state agency's expenditure limitation. And this bill would make those expenditures non-limited, those reimbursements non-limited, and encourage state agencies to use the reemployment assistance reserve. We had a couple of instances in the last biennium where people began to use it, but they did have to come to the emergency board, and that is a definite impediment to the use of this account.
Okay. Anybody from the Department of Insurance and Finance here? Anybody who otherwise cares about this?
What's the relating clause?
What's the relating clause? Reimbursement of reemployment assistance.
Kind of narrow.
Fine.
All it does is make those expenditures non-limited. They still show in an agency's budget, but they show as a non-limited,
okay,
and doesn't have them have to come to the
okay, work session.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair. I understand the situation.
Representative Shiprock moves Senate Bill 57 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, unamended. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1204. And Senator Yee, this is your bill.
This is my bill. Well, Mr. Chairman, can I read my testimony from here? Do you want me to?
You can read it from here.
Okay, I'll read it from here. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you all have a copy of
yes,
my testimony. For the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19. As a member of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, I came upon a Washington law requiring employers to report their new hires. When I tried to encourage AFS to follow through with the auditor's recommendation to collect $5.5 million more in collections. And the recommendation is that the auditor's recommendation is that they should act faster in collecting welfare overpayments. And I'm told that it is very difficult to collect welfare overpayments once it was made, but we may prevent overpayment of welfare payment by having the same Washington law. And the Washington law also helps with child support enforcement. Senate Bill 1204, which models after the Washington law, is necessary. Should this law become law, Oregon employers would be required to report all new hires within 15 days. Currently, employers report new hires' names and social security numbers to the Employment Division every 3 months, with 1 month of extension for filing. The problem with this system is that often a parent who owes child support will take a job and then quit before his employer even reports him. Consequently, it is nearly impossible for the other parent to collect child support because he or she never knows where the owing parent is. Senate Bill 1204 makes reporting easy on employers. All that the employer has to do is to make a copy or fax the information in of the new hire's W-4 form or call a toll-free number or use voice response to the Employment Division. Reporting new hires in a timely manner would allow the state to attach part of the wages of the parent who owes child support. Under Senate Bill 1204, statewide lists of new hires would be compiled weekly by the Employment Division and forwarded to the Child Support Enforcement Recovery Services of the Adult Family Services Department. This list would be compared by computer against lists of parents not paying child support.
When the names matched, notices will be sent to employers as well as employees according to as well as the employees for child support collection. According to AFS revenue analysis, under Senate Bill 1204, families will receive about $6 million per year in child support. To many families, this is critically needed for survival and may spare them from going on welfare. There will also be approximately $630,000 returned to general fund as an offset to welfare payment and $1.1 million returned to federal government for their share of it. This bill will also prevent welfare overpayment when the employment status of welfare applicants can be immediately verified. It is estimated conservatively that about $110,000 general fund and $190,000 federal funds can be saved. And this is, there will be potentially savings of preventing overpayment of unemployment insurance when this bill passes. And perhaps this is an area that can be monitored and recommendations can be made to prevent overpayment of unemployment insurance. According to the Employment Division, this bill will require 3.2 FTE to do the data capture and system maintenance, a one-time computer system modification, and an 18-month toll-free lines for employers to use to make the reports. The fiscal impact is $149,000 to be matched by federal government. There are representatives from Adult Family Services, Recovery Services Division, Child Support Enforcement, the Employment Division, and the Secretary of State's Auditing Division to provide testimony and answer questions. Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is predicted to bring $11.1 million in revenue to the federal, state governments, and Oregon families, but only about $150,000 cost to the state in implementation, a measure that brings you a 70 times return just during the first 18 months of implementation. Next bi-